Hey, Laura Murphy Oates with you on the Hack Podcast, coming to you from Gadigal Land on the Eora Nation. So, do you remember your first day of work? You probably felt pretty anxious, right? But imagine rocking up in a wheelchair and not being able to get around.
It was only at the beginning of the last sitting that a ramp was fitted into the Senate so that I can actually access the Senate floor.
That's Greens Senator Jordan Steele-John talking there. And today we'll be talking all about the barriers to getting a job when you have a disability. Plus, the healing power of magic mushrooms. Yep, mushrooms are going mainstream and Australia is getting on board. More on that later, but first.
And therefore I give notice that Boris Johnson is elected as the leader of the Conservative and Unionist Party.
Yeah, so if you haven't heard yet, there's a new Prime Minister in the UK. Boris Johnson has won the leadership of the ruling Conservative Party by a landslide, and he's a pretty controversial figure. He once called Muslim women letterboxes and rose to popularity by going on British comedy shows. He's also campaigned hard for Brexit, so Britain can leave the European Union. And now Boris Johnson has said that leaving the EU is one of his first priorities, but he's got a massive task ahead. So, how did we get here? Avni Dias reports.
Yeah, look, I mean, I cannot swear that I've always observed a top speed limit in this country of 70 miles an hour. I'm gonna.
Now, what are you asking here? It's perfectly true that I have had some drugs.
You lied to the people of London in your
own. Oh, get stuff.
So if you Google Boris Johnson's funny moments, you will not be disappointed. There's this time he spear tackled a Japanese child while playing soccer. He once wrote a limerick about the Turkish president saying he had sex with a goat. And there was this time he became a massive joke after falling over in a river.
It was all going well. And then not so well.
And
then
the
really
bit.
Badly.
This is the best bit. He actually pulls down the volunteer with him.
Yeah, you can't make this stuff up. This guy is the new Prime Minister of the United Kingdom after winning a vote to become the leader of the ruling Conservative Party.
I give notice that Boris Johnson is elected as the leader of the Conservative and Unionist Party.
I say to all the doubters, dude, we are going to energise the country. Like some slumbering giant, we are going to rise and ping off the guy ropes of self-doubt and negativity.
The vote wasn't even close, and he celebrated by saying dude a lot for some reason. With Boris Johnson's dishevelled blonde hair, his entertaining and comedic persona has helped him rise to the very top. And analysts say that, along with his theatrical dealings with journalists...
Will you comment?
Will you have a cup of tea?
Will you put it up for your comment?
Would you like a cup of tea?
Make him a lot like Donald Trump, who was heaping praise on the new PM.
They're saying Britain Trump. They call him Britain Trump, and people are saying that's a good thing. That they like me over there. That's what they wanted. That's what they need. It's what they need. He'll get it done. Boris is good. He's going to do a good job.
Boris Johnson really set his place in the UK by leading the charge for Brexit, sometimes even flat out lying about how much the EU takes from Britain.
You cannot sell bananas in bunches of more than two or three bananas.
But his predecessor, Theresa May, failed three times to unite the Conservative Party to secure a plan for how to leave the EU.
The choices we face are stark and the timetable is clear. It is incumbent on both front benches to seek to work together to deliver what the British people voted for.
Theresa May was trying to leave the European Union but keep things like free trade deals or ensure it won't be too difficult for people to move across borders. But many members of the party, including Boris Johnson, have said that was just a semi-Brexit but wasn't doing the full job. The new PM says he'll get Brexit through even without a deal like Theresa May was negotiating by the end of October.
We're going to get Brexit done on October the 31st. We're going to take advantage of all the opportunities that it will bring in a new spirit of can-do.
Leaving the EU totally cold, though, could have detrimental effects, like a lack of medicine being imported into the UK or stopping the huge proportion of food which comes from continental Europe. But Boris and the Brexiteers say a no-deal exit from the EU would deliver British sovereignty and get rid of the bureaucracy of the European Union, like the people voted for.
I have always had grave concerns about leaving the EU without a deal in place.
That's the Education Minister, Anne Milton. She resigned just before Boris Johnson was announced the new leader. Several other ministers have signalled they'll also quit because the idea of a no-deal Brexit is just too reckless. So Boris Johnson is walking into a tough task, uniting the Parliament as the hugely divisive new leader of the United Kingdom.
I will work flat out from now on with my team that I will build, I hope, in the next few days, to repay your confidence. But in the meantime, the campaign is over and the work begins.
Hack on Triple J.
Yeah, that's Boris Johnson ending that story from Abney Dias. Professor Simon Tormey is an expert in European politics at Sydney University. Simon, we've just heard about Boris's pretty wild ride to the top. He does seem to be a pretty polarising character. And Trump has come out and said he's Britain's version of Trump. Is that remotely true?
I think there's a certain element of truth there. I think Boris is a kind of charismatic, well-understood, well-known figure in British public life. He's hosted comedy programmes. He's got a very kind of offhand way, lots of jokes and lots of sort of self-mimicry and so on. So there's a kind of Trumpian element to Johnson.
Is that the only similarity, though? Is he pretty hardline?
He's not really. I think another similarity is actually neither of them are people of principle. They're not conviction politicians. They don't really have a very firm ideology. They're politicians based on gut instinct and certain values and a certain view of the world, which is quite similar. So I don't think the analogy is unfair.
Yeah, his election hasn't been greeted very warmly. A bunch of ministers have resigned and Scotland's first minister has tweeted out that she has profound concerns. What's behind this?
What's behind this is, of course, Brexit itself is a profoundly divisive issue in British politics, and he has set his stall out as being the person who's going to get it done by October 31st. Mm-hmm. So that is putting the wind up Scottish nationalists, people in Northern Ireland, and the 48% of people, frankly, who didn't want to leave the European Union in the first place.
Are there particular moments that have not instilled confidence in Boris Johnson as a Prime Minister?
Well, let's put it the other way. There aren't very many instances where he has instilled confidence in people because he tends to be very gaffe-prone. He's indelicate. He tends to call things by names that other people wouldn't use. So diplomacy is not his strong point, and he was Foreign Secretary until very recently, and that's what you need, diplomacy.
We just heard about a whole bunch of pretty hilarious moments, really, where he's been in public and been a bit of a showman. Does any of them stick out for you?
Yeah, I mean, there's a very classic image of Boris just before the Olympic Games in London, which he hosted as Mayor of London, where he's suspended from a trapeze wire, his trousers around his ankles, he's got a plastic helmet on his head and waving two Union Jacks. So one of his qualities is actually the ability to laugh at himself, and that's quite endearing for the British public. And, of course, people are looking for someone to cheer them up, and they're hoping Boris is going to do that.
On the text line, Tom says, I'm pretty sure he's Donald Trump's long-lost twin. Rob from Byron says, the people don't want to leave the EU anymore. Even Boris Johnson will find that out. And Tam says, oh, the irony of England wanting sovereignty. Good text in there. We're talking to Professor Simon Tormey. He's an expert in European politics about UK's new PM, Boris Johnson. So obviously his real big challenge is Brexit, which is a very complex and very messy situation. There's been a lot of talk about hard, soft, and no deal Brexit. Do you reckon you can break them down really quickly and simply for us?
Yeah, well, the key two positions are remain, so remaining within the European Union. That's what 48% of people voted for. And then the problem is divining what it is that the 52% wanted. Do they want a break from the single market, the customs union, the European Court of Justice and all the institutions, or do they just want more sovereignty? And that's what the debate's been over. Soft Brexit is kind of remaining within the orbit of Europe, whereas hard Brexit is really heading out into the North Atlantic.
Yeah, he said that he will get a deal on Brexit by October and he's open to a no-deal Brexit. People have said that would be catastrophic. What are some of the things that could come out of a no-deal Brexit?
Well, let's put it in these terms. I mean, the Calais-Dover border sees 90,000 lorries crossing every single day. So if you put borders up there and if you make it uncertain as to how lorries are going to cross, you're going to lose food, you're going to lose pharmaceuticals, supply chain dependent parts of the economy like car manufacturing. Go to the wall. So it really is a very big deal. It's basically cutting yourself off from your main market.
Mm. Okay, Simon Tormey, thanks so much for joining us.
I guess the biggest misconception people have about psychedelics is that these are drugs that make you crazy. And we now have evidence that that does happen sometimes. But in many more cases, these are drugs that can make you sane.
Yeah, Yep, magic mushrooms. You may think of them as just something you find in a milkshake in Bali, but more and more, they're being used for healing rather than just tripping. Scientists are getting on board with trials of mushrooms and other psychedelic drugs popping up around the world. In a moment, we'll chat to renowned science writer Michael Pollan, who's written a whole book about it. But first, Joe Lauder spoke to an Aussie researcher who's leading the way in Australia.
Psychedelic medical research has had a renaissance, but we're still sort of at the early stages.
This is Dr. Martin Williams. He's a postdoctoral research fellow at Monash and the president of PRISM, which promotes psychedelic medical research in Australia. We're talking about psychedelic psychotherapy. Think of it like tripping with a qualified therapist there to support you.
The psychotherapy is really fundamental to the whole process, so I don't think anybody's really suggesting that the drugs themselves do all of the work.
You might have heard about the Melbourne mushroom trial that was announced earlier this year that Martin's leading. Basically, terminally ill patients in Melbourne's St Vincent's Hospital will be given psilocybin, which is the active component of magic mushrooms, in the hopes it'll reduce their anxiety and depression around death. The focus is on those patients who don't respond to traditional treatments like antidepressants.
They unfortunately are facing death without any respite. You know, they really don't have the scope to address their anxiety and depression.
The way the study works is this. Patients will undergo two sessions of therapy in the weeks leading up. Then they'll have two separate sessions that go for 6 to 8 hours.
We will be administering either synthetic psilocybin or a placebo to 30 participants overall.
The patients are in a cosy, chilled-out room that's not the regular hospital ward. There are two therapists with them, and they're given an eye mask and some headphones with music if they want to use them. Later on in the weeks following, there's more therapy to process what they went through. Martin says it's hard to describe the experience that psilocybin gives these participants, but it helps them process their place in the world and has a mystical effect.
That would enable them to put things into perspective. It might give them a greater sense of connection with the people around them, with their family, with their friends, with nature, with the world in general. And it just seems to give people a better perspective on where they fit into the overall picture.
The trial's starting in September and will go for a couple of years. It's running through the St Vincent's Palliative Care Unit, and Martin says their head psychologist, Dr. Marg Ross, approached him.
And what was the motivation, do you think, for the clinicians at St Vincent's?
Well, Marg Ross is very open in saying that she's been working with people in the palliative care field for quite some time, and she was really becoming frustrated by the fact that our current treatment options are very limited. Marg and her team were looking for some alternatives which would provide those people who are otherwise resistant to the current approaches with some sort of relief from their intractable anxiety and depression, and to offer people the prospect of a gracious and good death at the end.
It was off the back of a similar international study that had some impressive results that made the medical world take notice. 80% of the participants in that study had a significant reduction in their anxiety and depression levels, and that lasted for 6 months. In October last year in America, the FDA gave psilocybin breakthrough therapy status as a potential therapy for treatment-resistant depression. It's not just mushrooms that are being looked at in a different light these days. MDMA is having a similar medical renaissance. It's the main ingredient in ecstasy, and in the States, it was also given breakthrough status in 2017. In a trial of MDMA-assisted therapy for people with post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD, 53% of participants no longer qualified for the diagnosis of PTSD after the study.
MDMA tends to calm people down so that if they're re-experiencing, in other words, if they're going through an exposure therapy sort of experience, their natural adrenaline cortisol response, which would be the fight or flight response, is down-regulated.
Martin hopes that in 5 years' time, Australia will be on its way to having legal psychedelic psychotherapy.
I would like Australia to have completed the first couple of clinical trials and have other trials underway and use those in conjunction with the results from overseas trials, ultimately to have both psilocybin and MDMA rescheduled as prescription medicines.
You're listening to Hack on Triple J.
Yep, that's Dr. Martin Williams finishing that story by Joe Lauder, talking about a pretty groundbreaking trial of magic mushrooms in Australia. What do you think? Should mushrooms be viewed as medicine? Give us a call on 1300 055 36, or you can get us on the text line on 0439 757 555. Michael Pollan is a world-renowned science writer. He's written a bunch of books about food, but his latest is about psychedelic drugs. Now, Michael, after LSD was discovered in the 1930s, people were really excited about its medical potential. What happened?
You know, most of us think of LSD and psychedelics in general as a product of the 60s, of the counterculture. And in fact, they were discovered before that. And all through the 50s, there was a very active period of serious scientific research trying to figure out what these new drugs might be good for. Everyone knew they had a powerful effect on the brain and on the mind, but no one knew how they could be used. So there was a lot of experimentation. And gradually they figured out that LSD and psilocybin could be used to help people break addictions, especially to alcohol, that they could be used to treat depression. And there were all these experiments, and they went on, and people really thought this would be a psychiatric wonder drug. But then when the 60s counterculture embraced the drugs and they got out of the lab, they became street drugs, there was a backlash.
So by 1970, LSD was outlawed in the US. Was there a legitimate health risk or a scientific basis for making LSD illegal?
Yes and no. Basically, LSD and psilocybin are remarkably non-toxic chemicals. They do not damage your body. And you can't say that about too many. They're over-the-counter drugs that people buy all the time, things like Tylenol that are toxic and can kill you if you have too many pills. LSD and psilocybin are also not addictive. But they can lead to psychological difficulties in some people. Mm. There are cases of people having psychotic breaks and schizophrenia beginning. This is probably something that was going to happen anyway to somebody, but an LSD trip can be the trigger. Of course, so can cannabis and so can alcohol.
Mm. So in the course of researching this book, you met so many people using this drug for therapeutic reasons. Were there moments that really struck you that for some people, these drugs have transformative powers?
Yeah, I interviewed dozens of volunteers and patients and therapists. There is enormous promise. I talked to cancer patients who lost their fear completely after one session. There was a man, he was dying and had a lot of anxiety and depression around that. And he entered a trial at New York University in Manhattan and had a profound trip. And the last 17 months of his life after this trip were, he described, the best months of his life. Mm. He had never been so happy. He became reconciled to death. He lost his fear. And I saw a picture of this man 3 or 4 days before he died. And he's emaciated. He's, you know, he's incredibly drawn and skinny. And he's beaming. So that had a profound effect on me. And it made me realize that this is something we need to explore.
It does seem like right now, every week, there's a new study about the ways in which psychedelics can be used therapeutically. Is there incredibly strong evidence for the use of LSD or mushrooms for certain conditions?
Yeah, for anxiety in cancer patients, it's been proven to be very effective. And there is some indications that it helps with depression of all kinds. Alcoholism is being studied right now in New York, and there's a big trial of that, which is very promising. Cigarette smoking, to stop smoking cigarettes. There was a pilot study that was very successful, and now there's a slightly larger study. So we're in the middle of this process. It may well be, though, within 5 years or so, that psilocybin will be approved as a medicine and be available to help people. And it can't come a moment too soon, because the tools that we have right now to treat all these situations are just not very good.
Are governments and health authorities getting behind using these drugs for treatment fast enough right now?
In the United States and in Europe, I would say yes. The regulators have been very supportive of the researchers. I would say the one limitation is that no government money is being used to support the research, which is often the case. I think they just regard it as too controversial. But the regulators are encouraging the researchers to go forward. In the case of psilocybin for depression, the U.S. Government has given it what's called breakthrough therapy designation, which means that they're going to speed the process and help the researchers. So, yeah, there doesn't appear to be any kind of government force standing in the way.
So in your view, after going on this whole journey, how should psychedelics be used and viewed within our society going forward?
So I think they have a place in medicine and mental health care. And I think that, you know, look, I mean, they'll help people who are ill, but I think all of us are dealing with some depression, some sadness, some anxiety, fear of death. I mean, these are kind of universal conditions. So I really do believe they have something to offer people who are not sick as well.
Okay, Michael, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Laura.
Hack on Triple J.
That's Michael Pollan, a science writer, talking about the case for using psychedelic drugs as medicine. And on the text line, we've got the changes the psychedelics can make to the quality of death in palliative care is so good, and I'm so happy it's finally coming. Another text saying anything that has potential to help people live with mental illness should at least be studied without bias. Thanks for texting in.
There is a misconception that when you have a disability, you are broken, less capable, and unemployable. There's an assumption that you can't do something, even though you probably can.
Triple J.
Yeah, so if you are an unemployed young person, you'll know that looking for a job is really hard. Now imagine that on top of that, you're living with a physical or even intellectual disability. Yep, turns out people with disability are twice as likely as other Australians to be unemployed. But Dylan Alcott, friend of Triple J and all-round legend, wants to change that. We're going to talk to Dylan in a sec, but first here's Shalila Medora explaining just what you're up against when you're living with a disability.
Thank you, everyone. I actually thought I had no chance of winning because when I got here, I only saw stairs and there was no ramp. I'm like, I can't win.
Dylan Alcott is a lot of things. He's a broadcaster, Paralympian, and Logie Award winner.
There's a ramp out the back, baby, which I was pretty happy about.
He's adding another string to his bow, campaigner. Dylan's launched a campaign called Remove the Barrier that's taking aim at unconscious bias. About 1 in 5 Australians lives with a disability, but only 54% have jobs, making them twice as likely to be unemployed as other Australians.
There is a misconception that when you have a disability, you are broken, less capable, and unemployable. There's an assumption that you can't do something, even though you probably can, even if you do it in a slightly different way. And because of that, people with disabilities don't get fair employment opportunities.
There's no physical challenge for me to get, say, a job interview. It's really only when you get into the interview, it can play on your mind.
Laurie Lawira is a TV reporter with SBS. He's also got a limb difference.
Simply put, I have one finger on my right hand. So I was born like this.
His limb difference doesn't stop him from reporting the news.
Never really had any inclinations to put it on a resume as such.
But it makes him wonder how he'd be received in job interviews.
Obviously, the first handshake, whether, you know, I would be seen differently.
Laurie lucked out because SBS doesn't see his limb difference as a problem. He now makes a point of not hiding his hand when he's on camera.
It really wasn't a problem to my bosses and has never been.
But he knows that his case isn't the standard.
A lot more people with disabilities will encounter great difficulty because employers, and they're not doing it deliberately or out of malice, it's simply because workplaces aren't accommodating of people with disability.
Green Senator Jordan Steele-John knows this from first-hand experience.
It says a lot about our society that even in the place where democracy lives, a disabled person was never expected to be, and therefore they didn't make any allowances or attempt to modify the design until one rocked up randomly.
He has cerebral palsy and is the first person who uses a wheelchair to be elected in the Senate. Ever. He's been in Parliament since 2017, but the place still isn't accessible for people who use wheelchairs.
It wasn't 6 months until I had an office that I could go to the loo in because none of the offices have accessible toilets. The doors are in many of the rooms across the building are too narrow. The carpets are of a thickness that it's like trying to self-propel through treacle. It was only at the beginning of the last sitting that a ramp was fitted into the Senate so that I can actually access the Senate floor. But then I can't get back up into my office because the doors aren't motorised.
Senator Steele-John thinks that part of the reason workplaces like his are so ill-equipped for people with disability is because we as a society still have super outdated views of what we think they can and can't do.
In my experience, it is prejudice, plain and simple. Confront the reality that we have some really negative views in our community around disabled people, and the flow-on effect is that we live in poverty and find it very difficult to be given a go in the workforce.
The Senator is totally on board with Dylan's Remove the Barrier campaign, and he reckons it should be backed up with legislation.
Great first step would be for our public service at the federal level to have a actual disability employment target of 15%.
Hack, Triple J.
That's Green Senator Jordan Steele-John ending that report by Shalila Medora. And it is pretty shocking. You know, so many Aussies are living with a disability, but so few are employed, just over half. I want to hear your stories of looking for work when you have a disability. Maybe you found it hard, or maybe you've got an awesome employer. Give us a call on 1300 055 36, or you can get us on the text line on 0439 757 555. But first up, we've got Dylan Alcott joining us. He's actually fresh from winning like a bunch of tennis championships, but somehow has found some time to launch his campaign. Dylan, what is it all about?
Hey, it's so good to be here. So good to be back on Triple J. You know, as mentioned, it's people with disabilities face a lot of, you know, barriers in everyday life. Some of them are real life, like accessibility, like the Senator was talking to. But probably the hardest one to overcome are the invisible barriers, things like unconscious bias, discrimination, and a lack of opportunity. And we want to shine a light on those invisible barriers to show, you know, Australians and all around the world that people with disability can absolutely kick ass in what they do.
I want to break down what you mean by invisible barriers and unconscious bias in particular. How does this actually come about when people are looking for jobs, and have you experienced it?
Yeah, it's from prejudice from the past and things like that. You know, I think the hardest ones are a lack of expectation of what people think you can do, a negative stigma about having a disability, and a perception that you can't do something as well as an able-bodied person. But people with disability, they're actually great employers, more productive than able-bodied people. They also take 8 less sick days per year than able-bodied people, Telstra did a study.
Yeah, wow.
And also they are retained in a role a whole extra year than an able-bodied person. So that sounds like an unbelievable employee. And I remember I once went to a job interview, got there. It was upstairs. So rather than come downstairs and interview me, guess what they did? Cancelled the interview.
Just because I was in a chair. Wow.
They said, you're not going to be able to work here. And that was it.
That's crazy.
It's tough.
So there was a particular story of a woman called Ashley who was a big part of this campaign. What's her story?
Yeah, Ash Jamison, she was an awesome girl. She's in an electric wheelchair, 21, had never had a job. She once applied for a job as a receptionist, and she got told she couldn't do it, they weren't looking. And then 5 minutes later, sent her best mate in who was able-bodied, and she got the job straight away. And unfortunately, Ash passed away 3 months before this campaign came out. So we're kind of doing it in memory of her and in memory of anyone with a disability that can't get a job, because we want to help the next young generation of young people, everybody listening to this station right now. You know, if you know someone with a disability or you have a disability yourself, we want to hear your story using hashtag remove the barrier.
On the text line, we've got All Caught for PM. Another text
Please
saying,
vote.
Tam says, as someone with an invisible disability, it's more so keeping the job than getting one. Essentially, they didn't know they signed up for an employee with a disability and you get let go for not being a good fit. I want to hear a bit more about this kind of bias that people come up against. I think a lot of people don't want to think that they're capable of something like this, but it's obviously such a big problem. Why is this so widespread? Like, where is this coming from?
Yeah, exactly right. And, you know, you might think that people might know my name. I wouldn't get it. You know, I actually finished a shift here at Triple J and I went next door to get a coffee, and a lovely lady last year came up in tears. She was crying. I said, oh, my God, did you get robbed? Like, what happened? And she told me it was inspirational to see me there getting my own coffee.
Right?
So what if she's an HR manager, recruiter, school teacher?
You're like, I'm running a whole bloody channel. Well, I'm running a show at the moment.
I'm pretending to run a show. I probably stuffed it up.
Not the channel.
I probably stuffed up paneling and things like that. But you know what I mean? And that makes it hard. And there's so many stories out there. And that's what we're trying to get people to do by doing this campaign.
So if there's a business owner listening to this right now who's thinking, that's all well and good, but this might cost me money or it might be a hassle, what do you want to say to them?
Yeah, you know what? Workplace adjustments are actually pretty cheap. For example, if I was to sit where you are right now and be hosting, all I do is move the chair and you actually save money. It's like BYO chair. We tell people to try and do 3 things for us. 1, start talking about it. Start having this conversation about how great employees with disability are. 2, share it. Share it on your channels. We really want people to use the hashtag remove the barrier on social media and start talking about it. And 3, Let's stop using the lip service. Let's act on it. There are, if you go to our website, removethebarrier.com, there's actual tips there of how to go about it. There's case studies. There's stories of people dominating in the workplace. And, yeah, we're really excited about the uptake so far.
Okay, Dylan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me back.
That is all we have time for, unfortunately.
Hack Triple J.
And just for you podcast listeners, we've got Dylan Alcott to hang around for a couple more questions. So we've just heard a suggestion from the Green Senator, Jordan Steele, John, that there should be legislation around this. What types of things can we do, you know, in Parliament, in law?
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, he's killing it and it's so good to have a representation in there. I think one of the big things is people sometimes think quotas are tokenistic. So if you have a quota for, you know, females, race, disability, whatever it is, you know, people often think it is tokenistic potentially, but I think it can lead to, you know, real positive change because it does set, you know, a mark that we have to get to. 20% of the population has a disability in this country, 4.5 million people. He wants 15% to be, you know, employed, which would be awesome. Super hard because currently it's not even close to that compared to that. So, you know, even if we got, you know, between 10%, example, in the public sector, only 3% of all employees in the public sector have a disability. 3%.
Yeah, wow. Yeah,
20% is that. So that's
not
good
enough. That's pretty stark.
Yeah, exactly right. So I think it could work. But, you know, I think we really need to shine a, rather than yell at people to do things, let's work with people to shine a positive light to change our perception because I think that's the best way to go about it.
Obviously, there's probably some people listening who are living with a disability and are searching for a job right now and are maybe having a pretty hard time. What's your message to them?
Yeah, I think first and foremost is back yourself. There are some real dickheads out there who are going to shut you down and that really stops you from doing stuff. You know what I mean? The same as if you're able-bodied, you want to go on a date and you get knocked back, you get knocked back again. Third time, you're like, I'm going to give up.
Persistence is key.
It is. And it's like that for people with disability with employment. You just give up. Keep trying because the changing of the tide is coming and there are now people out to help. You know, like that's why we're doing this campaign. And, you know, I've had people not care about me for years and all of a sudden they're kind of buying in and that's been awesome for
me. Logies are coming your way.
Exactly right. and you know what? I'm not saying that, you know, I'm the real lucky one and I want to try and help more people feel like that. And that's why people are getting out there and spruiking it. And, you know, please keep trying. One other thing is there are great services out there who can back you. And there are great companies. Like when I got a job here at Triple J, no one gave a shit that I was in a wheelchair. They really didn't. And it really was great. And, you know, I think I've been lucky to be supported and I just want more, you know, especially young people with disability to have the chances of it.
Okay, Dylan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it. Share the podcast. Woo!
Yeah, thanks everyone for joining us on the Hack Podcast.